Hey, welcome everyone. Welcome to News of the Money World. Another episode. There's stuff going down and lots to talk about. Rupert, how are you going today?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. I think we should just get stuck into it. Let's talk about the elections. Let's talk about Biden's performance. That's going to be fun. And what's happening with India as well. It seems like they're waking up and going to the next level. So let's get started with just this, the shift to the far right. I don't know. Every time I read any articles around what's happening in Germany, what's happening in France, even what's happening in the US, it seems like we're all shifting to the far right. It's like not even possible anymore just to be left or right. We have to be extreme in everything that we use. Everything is a crisis. Everything is far. And I guess what's happening in France is just another example of it. Perhaps there is a little bit of far rightness going on in that case, though. But with what's going on right now in Europe in general, what do you think is driving all of this, I guess, rebellion? But what's driving this move?
So just for kind of a little bit of context for everyone. So over the weekend, the French voted. Emmanuel Macron called an early election because he was nervous about what happened in the European elections. I think it was about a month ago where the far right took a very strong positioning. And so his view was, to stop this, I'm just going to call an immediate election in France. And unfortunately, that seems to have backfired. It seems to have been one of the worst political decisions we've seen for a while, followed very closely by Biden agreeing to do a debate, but we'll come to that in a second. And what it's coming out as is actually the Front National, the FN, which is kind of, it's a bit of a far-right fringe. Previously, it was a fringe party in France. They look as though they are going to kind of get pretty close to a majority on their own, which is almost unheard of in the French kind of election system. They have the policies around, they are shutting down immigration. They're very anti-immigrant. They very much hark back to, they want the old style France from back in the 1960s. They want to reduce the pension age. A whole series of policies that, to be blunt, make very little sense. But I think everyone's starting to get a bit nervous because it looks as though they are now going to be the largest party in France. Admittedly, in France, there is a little bit of separation. You've got the office of the president, which is different to the office of the prime minister, who is elected by parliament. And so there is kind of, it's not full out there, but it's definitely making markets pretty nervous, right? Because all of a sudden you've got someone that's saying, hold on a sec, Russia's our friend. We shouldn't be supporting Russia. We shouldn't be fighting with Ukraine, shutting down immigration, lowering pension age, constantly attacking Europe in a similar way to kind of Nigel Farage did in the UK. Yeah, there's kind of some pretty strong potential for volatility as we try and unpick what this means. So after that context, now I can finally answer my dribble. I can answer your question. What do I think is driving all of this? I think it is, in the last 4 or 5 years, I think there's been a massive fusion of wealth. We've got the rich have got a lot richer. So anyone that owns assets has done extremely well. And anyone that hasn't owned assets is really struggling. We've got inflation riding at all-time highs. And I think there's just a lot of people that are going, you know what, I'm feeling left behind. The political system over the last 20 or 30 years, it actually hasn't helped me. If anything, I feel poorer than my parents. It kind of times feel as though they're going worse. And this is just voters reacting and voters looking to do stuff differently, right? And to be fair, we're seeing it everywhere in the world. We're kind of in the US with kind of the Trump phenomenons, which we've kind of seen coming and going. We're seeing it in France, seeing it in Germany. We're seeing it everywhere. I think it's kind of, it's more a reflection of just how unhappy people feel right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be as simple as that, because like you alluded to, if there's elements of, hey, we want to do our own Frexit, right? I think that's the term that they used, or they want to kind of get tougher on immigration and defining who is a French citizen a little bit more articulately. They're obviously capturing the essence of how people are feeling, and people are feeling like that for a reason, we need to remember, right? And you alluded to the haves and the have-nots, that widening gap, I would suggest that that's probably not a left or right thing. That's an up and down thing.
It is.
You know, go ahead.
But the truth is, though, it's the right. So I think there's a couple of things. It's the right that are proposing solutions. And so if anything, how do I put this delicately? I don't think I can. There is a strong view that the woke world that we have been in over the last kind of 20 or 30 years has driven us to where we are. And so therefore the answer and the antidote is anti-woke. And that's why I think we're starting to see the fringe on the far right get pushed a lot harder. It's probably because globally politics have moved to the left in a lot of places as we go.
Mm.
There is kind of one, I think the piece though, I think when you raised a really great question in your introduction around why do we call them all the hard right? Why don't we have just the right? And I think, I'll be honest, I suspect it's a little bit of sensationalizing by the media. And I think there's a bit of sensationalizing happening, which is driving a big chunk of these conversations. Because let's be honest, let's have a look at what happened in Italy. When Italy, they had their new government elected last year, and that was seen as a hard right, fascist kind of style government and all of those negative words and all of that kind of stuff. And everyone's going, yeah, actually, it's all gone pretty good so far. She's kind of, I've forgotten the lady's name, but she's managing it in a way which most people go, yeah, it kind of makes sense. And we haven't seen any of those extremist tendencies that we've seen so far. And I think even when we look at France, sure, the party is still called the Front National, but Marine Le Pen is nowhere near as extreme as her father was, and nowhere near as extreme as the kind of the policies she was espousing even 5 or 10 years ago. She's very much brought it mainstream. And so I think your comment is probably the best one, is why are we correct in calling it far right, or should we just be calling it kind of nationalistic and right wing?
Yeah, yeah, just good old-fashioned right wing. There's no harm in that. And I think it's interesting because you're right. Like, no matter where you go in the media, it always refers to far right as it tars it with this brush of extremism, right? And it's making the assumption that everybody agrees with that. But in reality, as we can see with France, not everybody agrees with that. And so at some stage, you have to acknowledge that who people are actually voting for in power represents what the majority of people actually want. And I think that, you know, what you were saying with the Italian leader, is that, I'm trying to remember her name as well, but I think that that whole idea of actually voting against something is very different to voting for. It has to be some sort of solution that actually works rather than just the opposite of what we've seen, which kind of ties in nicely, I guess, to what we've seen in the United States with this presidential debate with two people that perhaps both sides don't really want, but it really is a choice of who do we hate the most, and therefore let's vote for the opposite of that, which just seems so wrong on so many levels. But that seems to be where we're at in politics. And I think it's, again, another really fascinating thing, which we've seen through the lens of the media, is that most people have kind of been, I shouldn't say most people, people probably slightly in the middle or even a little bit to the left have probably been a little bit kind of more understanding of where Biden has been, like mentally speaking, whereas those more on the right would have been far more critical, just because that would be the default position, far more critical on his behavior and his performance, noticing that he wanders off on stage and he's shaking the hands of phantom ghosts as they walk by and just kind of blanking out, right? Like that kind of stuff has been visible for quite a while.
Yeah.
However, it was only recently in this debate that is like, all of a sudden, all the Democrats are like, goodness, he's not fit to govern. It's almost like people in the middle or on the left are waiting to be told what to think by the media. And I know that definitely we've seen that here in New Zealand. Absolutely. But with where U.S. politics is at, we're potentially going to see U.S. President Trump getting back in there. And I don't know what your thoughts are, but like I would probably say chances are it's a little bit more likely that he's going to get in than the other team. But yeah, what do you think? What do you think?
Well, look, to answer your question, I mean, the betting markets have it at a 65% probability after last night's, after the debate. I mean, for anyone that wants some great entertainment, go onto YouTube and have a look on the John Daly Show. He did an amazing skit on it, and it was truly amazing. I mean, Joe Biden had one single job, and that was to prove to everyone that he's not too old and he's not senile. And he failed miserably at that job. And I think Trump, he had kind of one job, and that was to kind of make Biden look senile. What was absolutely amazing is that it was probably, he was quieter than he's ever been, because he just kind of, all he did was let Biden's silences kind of kill the room, and that was all that was necessary.
Right. Unforced errors the whole time. Yeah,
exactly, right? So it's the kind of the best thing in the world. If your opponent can kill themselves, then you just watch and let them do it.
That's right, the art of war, yeah.
But I think the truth is it the press and is it the media that are kind of that are changing and kind of have created this narrative? I would argue no way. I think for what I can see from here, it looks as though everyone has been, to your introduction again, where you said he's been shaking hands with ghosts, he's been falling asleep at dinners, he's been doing stuff like this for the last kind of 12 months. And so everyone has been looking. That's why, I mean, you've never had such a big debate around whether an incumbent should stand or not stand. And the political whims were already split on the whole thing before this even happened. And a lot of people going, he shouldn't be there, he's too old, he's kind of all of that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, he kind of failed miserably. Not only did he fail to convince them that he wasn't, he kind of was young and agile, he kind of proved all the doubters entirely right, which is why these next series of conversations are going to be happening, right? And I think, yeah, it is a strange one. And it kind of, I think, is bringing into light what does actually a Trump presidency mean for the economy and mean for markets, right? Because the other thing that's kind of starting to happen is people are going, the current fear is that, hold on, if the Biden kind of hopefuls have decided it's a waste of time, they're not going to vote for president. That also means they don't vote for their congressman. That also means they don't vote for the relevant houses in the Senate. So when you get a whole lot of kind of Democratic supporters staying home, actually what this does is this significantly increases the chances that that he takes the full gambit and he ends up kind of, so Trump ends up controlling the Senate, Congress, and the presidency, which is what he had for the first 2 years of his last presidency. And that actually, I have a suspicion, that will actually allow him to kind of affect real lasting change, which will be really interesting.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about what that change is, what he wants, there's been massive talk on tariffs. And it's hard to see tariffs not kind of being wrapped up further than where they are today. Immigration is going to be a massive target. So you end up kind of reducing immigration and cutting immigration to zero potentially. Or even negative immigration by the time you deal with all the illegal immigrants. He has talked about increasing defense spending, increasing social security entitlements, decreasing tax rates. And so it's kind of, from an economist's perspective, it's all pretty scary, right? Because you end up in a world where you've got lack of immigration. That means your workforce is cut, and that means that you're kind of going to have stronger wage growth than you otherwise would have, so highly inflationary. Tariffs, that means all your physical goods get more expensive. Again, highly inflationary. And it's not just the international stuff that lifts in prices. All of the domestic stuff that is being produced increases in prices as well, as they kind of look at price parity and they take that extra margin. And then, of course, when we look at Social Security, defense spending, and tax reform, all of those things mean higher deficits. And so it's kind of, it's pretty hard to see a Trump presidency not being a world where we have higher inflation and higher interest rates for a lot longer. And actually, and then you overlay the third part of it. So back in 2018, 2019, when he was president, there was a huge amount of jawboning about actually what the, about to Jerome Powell. He appointed Jerome Powell, but he was very much of the view that he was holding interest rates too high, he was destroying the economy, a lot more political interference than was due. So again, you go, higher inflation is kind of where his policy stance sits, but is he actually going to fire Jerome Powell or appoint a friendly central bank governor, Federal Reserve governor, that actually will mean that interest rates come down, which again means higher inflation for longer. So it is a really interesting cocktail and an interesting mix which we've got coming, I think. And that's why you've seen the volatility in the markets over the last 24, 48 hours. as investors are starting to go, fuck, Trump's real. This is probably going to happen. Are they going to start pricing some of that risk in?
Yeah. And above all the things that we can maybe speculate on and try and figure out as to what might happen, it's the fact that it is kind of uncertain, right? Like no one really knows what's going to happen. And yeah. So that increases volatility. Markets don't like volatility. That will be reflected in the price at some stage, I'm guessing.
But the one thing I would kind of strongly say, we always know, buy the rumor, sell the fact. And so what I find really interesting historically, that I've kind of seen some research on these historical elections and all of these things, right? Whether it be Trump back in 2016, whether it be the Italians that kind of, when that happened, everyone always thinks it's going to be chaotic and going to be difficult and nothing's ever going to happen. And we always see a dip in the markets leading up to kind of, or immediately after the event, but it all pretty quickly recovers because as much as probably they don't like to hear this, but they don't ever have anywhere near as much impact or affect anywhere near as much change as they do as they think they will. And markets realize that pretty quickly as well.
Sure. Yeah. Well, on that topic of not having as much influence as investors give them credit for, the US Federal Reserve or central banks in general using the interest rate mechanism, I think that's going to be interesting because, like in the context of that chat with Donald Trump, around Donald Trump right there, putting pressure perhaps to reduce rates and he's going to be spending a whole bunch. It's hard. Yeah, I agree. Hard not to see higher for longer in interest rates because of the inflation that would inevitably cause. But the other story that's kind of happening underneath all of this, which I've been trying to learn a little bit more about recently, and to be honest, I still got a little bit of work to do on this one, but the actual global liquidity, the flow of money seems to be almost more of a factor than the cost of money. And it's maybe akin to considering voltage versus current. And the interest rate differential or the change in interest rates may have an impact on markets for sure. But the actual global liquidity, the net new currency that's sloshing around the system, there's more than one lever that gets pulled to increase or decrease that. And that, I guess, will, which is starting to increase again right now. It kind of follows this 4-year cycle, funnily enough, with the election cycle. And so I think that that could be playing much more of a larger role this time around than in previous cycles because of the fact that there are probably more of a limited set of options. We now know that if interest rates are kept low for too long, that does create inflation. We've reached that. We've poked that bear, and we got to get that bear back in that hole, right? So I think that we're probably going to see higher interest rates for longer, personally, but more global liquidity. And I think that'll come out through asset prices in much the same way. But while we're kind of making the assumptions that interest rates will either put markets up or down, I think there is another force at work here. What do you think of that, though? Because it's not something that you hear a lot about the interest rate narrative, but not a lot about the global liquidity piece, because maybe it's a bit too complicated, perhaps.
Well, I think it is complicated. And I think it's also the story that no one wants to hear, because the problem we have, right, is governments are spending significantly more than they have. And it's actually the governments that keep on creating this liquidity, keep on creating it all as well. Interest rates are simple. Interest rates is something, and the inflation narrative impacts every single daily person. But actually the liquidity narrative and the fiscal spending narrative, that we're all kind of two steps removed from where that is as well. And so I actually agree. I think it's the liquidity piece, the fiscal piece, which is driving far more of where we are at right now than interest rates. But I don't know what the right answer to do that is, right? Because again, if we're in a world where people are being elected to because they're making outlandish promises, sensibility is not an easy way to kind of to stop that, right? And even when we look at New Zealand, little old New Zealand, right, where, I mean, we had a lot of conversations about the tax cuts and a lot of the stuff that's happening here, but it's no different, right? It's everyone wants their sugar hits. Everyone wants that little bit of candy that they can distribute to buy them a few more votes.
And actually, Lynn Alden has a lot to say about this. She's a macro commentator that I follow a little bit of her work. And she calls it, I'm pretty sure she hasn't coined this phrase, but fiscal dominance, right? Where instead of the monetary dominance, where central banks are really in control of the story. It's governments now that are in control of that. And I think that is something that we just need to be mindful of. Let's do talk about India, though, because I'm really interested in India, partly because I kind of see it as maybe like China 2.0 or the next iteration of the developing world coming onto the main stage. We've seen a pickup in private equity. We've seen the MSCI index. I think it was the MSCI.
That's the JP Morgan bond indices.
Thank you. Okay. Tentatively, you know, we're adopting them into, there's going to be more funds flowing into that country, and that will increase over time, and that will change India's economy significantly. They've done a lot of work getting used to the concept of foreign capital coming in. And I think that that could be a really interesting opportunity for investors. So within that emerging market category or the rest of the world indexes out there, I think that could be perhaps a big contributor, right? Where does this go from here? And do you think that it's going to be a pretty black and white, simple, hey, welcome to the club, India? Or do you think that could be a bit challenging?
So India's a really interesting one, right? And like many emerging markets, it's had its rides, it's had its ups and downs, had a big boom in that pre-2008 period. And it's actually had a great boom post-COVID as well. But it's been a difficult market for investors because it's very different to other. It feels as at times the government just doesn't seem to care about external investors and external capital. And it's also a country which is controlled by a small number of very, very large conglomerates as well from an economic perspective. But that's kind of starting to change. People are waking up to the idea that India is now, I think, the largest population in the world at 1.4 billion people. So it's a massive domestic economy that over the last 10 years has got much, much wealthier. And kind of the amount of people they're lifting out of poverty is truly outstanding. And it's a very different story. So in some respects, that's very similar to what happened in China 35 years ago.
Yeah.
The big difference what's happening in India is they're managing to build an internal economy. And so they're building quite a strong middle class. They're building a lot of the very large successful companies in India are actually supplying the Indian market. And it's a lot more open than the Chinese economy as well, right? So you can actually, so it's the telcos, admittedly, a lot of it's controlled by the Reliances and those kind of people. But it's the telcos, the TV companies, the banks, all of these companies which are actually privately owned and people are trying to figure out ways in which they can invest and which they can go. And it's arguably, it's a safer model to invest in because these are companies, and this is an industry, are investing in companies that are there to serve the domestic market and really drive kind of growth in India versus external. Over the medium term, it's even more interesting, right? Because as you think about how the Indian economy has set itself up, it set itself up as an economy in the services space. Its exports are largely services related, right? So a highly educated workforce, good rule of law, goodish kind of the law is there. It's just whether it's often applied or not. And then also kind of the fact that it's they're reaping the benefits of previously being an English economy, an English colony as well. And so it's kind of you look at that narrative and you go, actually, it should have a lot going for it and should have particularly as the world looks to age as an aging population. And then that's they will be able to provide services to the world. And actually the final piece to the puzzle is they've got a very young population. Unlike China, where over the next 50 years, the population might halve, India is likely to keep on growing. And so there's a hell of a lot that's there that makes it a really attractive investment destination. And I think that's what people are starting to see, right? I mean, as a stock market, it's up like 60% over the last 2 years. So the stock market's kind of done extremely well. We're starting to see individual investors go in, spend lots of time there trying to figure out. So that's the private equity guys and going, cool, this is the next big thing. Similar to where China was probably 10, 15 years ago. They're trying to do that in there. And then now the next big thing that's happened, which is going to be really interesting, is over the weekend, we've now got JP Morgan have included India in their bond indices. And India will now make up, it's kind of increasing over time, but it's going to make up 10% of the frontier markets bond portfolios. And what that will do is that will get a whole lot of, it'll make it much easier for Indian companies to raise external capital. It'll make it easier for the government, the banks, everyone to raise external capital. They're going to get more used to dealing in Indian rupees. You're going to get the infrastructure around being able to build derivatives, swaps, all of that kind of stuff there. And so that will be a big boom for that broader economy as you've got the world's fixed interest investor base going there. So it's kind of another really clear, it's a really clear kind of step on that path to kind of middle income countries, which is really, really important. However, it's important to note that for so many of these countries, we've been there before, whether it was Russia in the kind of early 2010s, whether it was Brazil, so many of these countries we've tried pretty hard to get there and it never quite works and it always seems to fall apart just when you think it won't. And so I think that's the big risk, right? It's still, it is a high risk economy, but it is coming a very long way. And I think 5 years ago, if you'd looked at India and gone, this is where what's going to happen with India today, everyone would have laughed at you, said no way. So it's come a very long way.
And I guess with good returns or the promise of good returns, there's a bumpy ride. So what you just said makes a lot of sense. We can't kind of just assume, hey, it's all good. But what I like about what you were saying there is that as well is that if we have a world which is more deglobalized and we have that the right demographics in India and they're focusing on building themselves up, then it does make a really good investment as something that's almost hedged against some of these other macro trends that aren't necessarily that good. Yep. Like if there is rising tariffs, if there is more of a trade war, well, hey, with services, like, you know, how easy is that to slap a tariff on digital services, right? I think that it's going to be an interesting one to factor in. And with like most portfolios and most funds and bringing it back to KiwiSaver here in New Zealand, again, we don't really have a massive exposure to India, for example, but do you think you can see a time where that might change as they mature?
I think so. Look, if you've got an emerging markets allocation, so under the MSCI weights, emerging markets should be about 13-14%. Sure. And India probably makes up of that 13-14%. I think India makes up about 10% of that. So look, if you've got a market neutral portfolio, you should have 2% in India. But it's not many will have that, right? I think over the last 15 years, the focus has really been on China. And a lot of that kind of investment has gone into the Chinese market versus India and some of those others. But after such a horrible 2 or 3 years for Chinese investors, it's looking as though people are going to be recycling their capital and moving it into that Indian market as well. The problem that you have with India, though, is you've still got issues, right? You've still got fears on accounting scandals. I mean, we looked at what happened last year with when Deep Horizon had it got reliant. Yeah, it is still a crony market, and it's still nowhere near as visible or transparent as we would like for investment as well.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mentioned China before, so let's talk about China, and let's talk about what's going on. So what I've been reading about this morning was just how the government's considering more of a bond issuance. Yeah. Yields are really low. I'm thinking about Japanese yen, how that's going to make exports coming out of Japan look pretty competitive. China has to be mindful of that as well. Thinking about potential more trade wars, even potentially a hot war going forward. So there's a lot of uncertainty there again. We still don't really have a lot of reliable data coming out of China, but you can kind of see that some things look good or the stuff that they do let out looks good. But at the same time, we know that from a property perspective, they're really struggling still. And so it's hard to know which way that whole thing could go. But do you feel like with the rise in India, that will attract a lot more capital from what would have gone to China?
Yeah, yes and no, right? I think yes, some of the market, some of the capital that was invested in China will definitely be moving into India, and there will be that switch. But it is still such a small part of overall people's portfolios that it's kind of, yeah, that's the bit that I find interesting. It's definitely small. And I think that the big challenge people are grappling with in China, and also you got to remember, it's never been that easy to invest in China. Very strict foreign exchange control, very strict around what you're allowed to buy. The state still controls a huge number of a big chunk of the industry there. So, yeah, I do think there will be more moving sideways. I think it's just really hard to see kind of where it lands and where it goes, right? And if you think about a Trump presidency, the bedrock of that Chinese economy is manufacturing and supplying the rest of the world, and that's going to get hard. Even over the weekend, what was it? There's now a call for that they want to put 100% tariffs on golf carts coming out of China because flooding the world.
Yeah.
It's going to be a really, really hard struggle to see them getting out of this. And then you look at kind of from a New Zealand perspective, yeah, it's kind of like where do we sit, right? I mean, we're currently buying, at home at the moment, we're buying big legs of lamb at the supermarket for $20. I mean, that's because China has got warehouses of refrigerated warehouses of this stuff kind of stacked up, and they can't get it out the door fast enough. Yeah, I think we are starting to see it here in New Zealand, and some of our core export markets are starting to get there. And I think it is going to mean hard for New Zealand until we start to see some material pickup in China. And unfortunately, New Zealand, we've got our links to China, but we don't have very good links into India. And that's because the Indians have got a very strong domestic agricultural market. And at the end of the day, they don't want to let New Zealand milk in, and they don't want to let New Zealand meat in, because they'd rather protect. They're still very protectionist against all of that stuff. Yeah. And so I think it is going to be very, very hard. From an NZ Inc. perspective, we would prefer the focus stay on China. But I think you're right. The focus is going to be moving towards India as we move forward.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, I think that pretty much sums up today's chat, really.
It was 35 minutes. I thought we'd be a whole lot quicker than that. That's good. Some roundabouts and always some interesting places to go.
No, that's good. It's good. Yeah, I think those topics that we did cover today will be probably one of the themes I think that we kind of need to watch throughout the rest of the year, especially with the election piece in the US. That's going to change things. That's going to mean a lot of potential volatility in share markets, which doesn't necessarily mean downwards, but it means that the possibility exists of a lot more of a bumpy ride between now and, say, the end of the year. So I guess a really good reminder, you know, we should be thinking long term. The market does go up more than it goes down. And so if you are investing for the long term, it's always a safer bet to stay long and not try to time the market like this. I know I say that all the time, but it is really important, especially when you're having conversations about all the dynamism that's happening in the short term and all the variability, volatility, and all that sort of stuff, right? It's important to always just remember that long-term focus. But great chat. Next week, we are taking a week off, though. School holidays here in New Zealand, so I'm taking the family away. Hopefully, you're taking some time off as well with the kids, but we'll see. And we'll catch up not next week, but the week after that. How's that sound?
Awesome. Well, thanks, Darcy, and enjoy the week with Kit.
All right. Always do.